This is tape two in the series of Dan Pollitt, and you were just saying.
Yeah. So I wasn't there. I told the dean, and I told the president of the university, who is John Caldwell, who later became the chancellor of state. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to fight all these bills as well as he could, and I was knew about such things, so I was sort of became his unofficial attorney. And we were pretty close, and I liked him very, very much. But I decided not to do it, and I think there is a philosophy professor who decided not to do it, and three or four architects in the School of Architecture who decided not to do it. So I didn't want to make a big fuss, but the student newspaper people knew that the philosophy professor wasn't going to do it, so we got some headlines, and so then it was to take effect at the end of the school year. I'd been there 2 years, and so I looked for a job, and went to Missouri, University of Missouri, where there was some interest in me, and University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and then here. Those were the three schools that wanted to interview me. Mm-hmm. And it, this I like this far better.
Okay.
Well, at Missouri, I didn't really like the dean. And it, I went to Pennsylvania, and I stayed with Maury Gelblum, who later, he had been a classmate of mine at college, and later he came here as an assistant dean. But it was that time of the year when slush, a lot of slush and dirty snow all over the place. And I liked most of the people I met there at Penn, but they seemed to be a little bit cold. And then I came here, and it was dogwood and redbud season, you know. And the air was so nice, and I stayed with the professor at his house, and everybody here was just so nice and obliging. I was the first one since Bill Aycock. And the faculty here, this law school has 100 years or more, mm-hmm. but it really doesn't. And President Chase, after World War I, up until after World War I, 1920, we'll say, it had been you could come here for 1 year and you take the bar, and if you passed it, you were through. If you didn't pass it, you came back for a second year. And so this was a 2-year law school, which was really a cram course for the bar. And the faculty consisted largely of retired state Supreme Court judges. So President Chase in 1920 decided to have a modern law school. And he would get people who knew the case method of instruction. And he decided to get the best people he could. And and the salary was high. He decided to get the average of Harvard and Columbia and Chicago, and that was the salary here. And so the salary here was better than you could get anywhere else. And he attracted a number of very good people who were 8 or 9 or 10 of them during the very early 1920s. And maybe 2 or 3 left. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, like 1931, they hired 2 more. And then they hired Henry Brandis in 1937. And then they hired Bill Aycock in 1947. And then he became the chancellor in 1957. And then they hired me. And nobody had been hired, really,
for 10 years, at least.
For 10 years, and before that, between Henry Brandis, mm-hmm. which was for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So when I came here in 1957, most of the people had been hired in their early 1920s. And they were very nice old gentlemen, you know, mm-hmm. who were all still very active doing things that I thought were very worthwhile.
What kind of things were they doing?
Well, if you don't mind, let me run down.
Yeah.
All right. This building is the Van Hecke Wettick building. Mm-hmm. Right. Van Hecke was the former dean for two terms or three terms, and he was the first Keenan. When the university started the Keenan chairs, he was the first one to get a Keenan chair in the whole university.
What is Keenan?
That's you're distinguished. So in any event, he met me at the airport when I arrived with his wife, Jessie. And the airport was then much, much smaller. And it was 8 o'clock at night. And we drove out of the airport and he turned the wrong way. We were almost to Raleigh. So he decided, his wife, Jessie, kept saying, "You're going the wrong way." And he said, "No, I'm not. I know how to drive. I've been here before." But it was sort of pleasant, you know. And then we turned around and came here, and we went to Herb Bear's house, which was right up here on Gimgul Street, where I was to spend the night with him because his wife was away. And we had hot chocolate and cookies waiting for me. So the Van Hecke's and Herb Bear and I had our refreshments and then the bed, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, I refused to take the oath.
So in Arkansas.
In Arkansas, and everybody knew, no question, I'm leaving because I won't take the oath. And so that, why won't you say you're not in any subversive organization? That's a matter of concern to people. So, in any event, that's what we talked about, mostly in my interviews here. But Van Hecke told me that. An interesting story, and that he had come here very young, you know, 3 years out of law school or something, in 1922 maybe, and he'd stayed here 2 years, and then he decided that he didn't like the dean, who was Dean McCormick of McCormick on Evidence. So he got a job at Kansas, and they went out there, and in 1924, there was the presidential election, and La Follette of Wisconsin was on the ticket. He was a third-party ticket. And every year, the law faculty and the state Supreme Court judges would have a dinner party at the downtown hotel, and they'd wear tuxedos, and the women would wear evening gowns. And at this particular year, they had a mock election, something to do. And they marked their ballots and put them in the ballot box. And it turned out that there were two votes for La Follette. And the newspapers went crazy. Which of the state Supreme Court judges is secret for La Follette? And so Van Hecke admitted that it was he and his wife who had voted for La Follette, whereupon he got fired. And then North Carolina offered him his job back. And he returned, and he had been the president of the American Association of Law Schools, which is all the law schools, maybe 2 years earlier, maybe in 1955, and they'd investigated an academic freedom violation at Dickinson Law School, and Van Hecke had found there had been a violation. And told them to rehire the people and that sort of thing, but the guys didn't want to go back. And one came to Arkansas and became a close friend of mine down there. And but they wouldn't pay him his transportation, so he called Van Hecke, and Van Hecke got after Dickinson. And he was really aggressive in protecting this guy's rights. And he had been... Frank Graham was a good friend of Harry Truman's, and Frank Graham was interested in the problem of migratory farm workers. So he told Truman that Truman ought to appoint a presidential commission on the problem of migratory farm workers. So he did, and he made Van Hecke the chairman of that committee. And it's a great study. It's really a great study. Well, I had been the chief counsel for the farm workers, which is the migratory farm workers.
When were you there?
When I was with Joe Rao. Uh-huh. And so I'd known about Van Hecke. And so there was him. He's a very nice guy, and he cared about people. And he's kept on. He taught equity, which they don't teach anymore, and labor law, which he didn't particularly like and was glad to get rid of. But he was also the chairman of the State Industrial Commission, which deals with appeals when people are denied workmen's compensation. And that was part-time, but he was the chair of that all the time he was here. So that's what he was doing. Now, Wedick is the other name. Mm-hmm. And Wedick was about the same age as Van Hecke. And
which was?
At that time, 65. But he had come here in 1922 or 3, and had stayed here. And he had been the mayor of Chapel Hill while he'd been a law professor. And then he started the Carolina Press and was the chairman of the Carolina Press.
And what is the Carolina Press?
The publishing company. They publish all the books. And he cared about publishing scholarly books and so on. So the first morning I was here, after we'd had our hot chocolate and cookies, we got up the next morning and we went to the Wedick's house to have breakfast. And Wedick had a lot of books. And told me that he was a publisher, and these were all the books that were published, and he was reading two or three, the manuscripts, and so on. And I like to read books, so I was impressed by that. And later on, we got to be friends, and he taught constitutional law. And there used to be parties of the faculty, 10 people, and there'd always be one a month at somebody's house. And he told me that in World War I, he had been a naval aviator, and there'd been very few. I mean, there were 50 at the most, maybe. And he was stationed in England, and every day he was supposed to fly the British Channel and bomb something in Germany or somewhere. And the planes were not very good, so at least one out of every 5 sorties, he would land in the British Channel. They had pontoon airplanes. They used to carry a fishing line. They'd sit there and fish, and waiting,
really?
Waiting to be, yeah, rescued. And he was such a pleasant-looking person and mild. And Van Hecke was mild in his appearance. But there's all that steel there, you know. So, and then he was married to Mrs. Wedick, who was very nice, and she couldn't stay for breakfast because she fixed it, but then had to leave because they were opening St. Thomas More that day. It was just been built, and they were opening it, and she was very active in the Catholic Church. And she told me, as before, she said, "Do you have any children?" And I said, "Yes, I have 2. And I said, "How old are they?" And I said, "One's 5 and one's 3 or something." And she said, "Well, just because you're on the law faculty doesn't mean your children can come to my day school." And she had the only day school in town at the time. And she says, "I have a waiting list, and you get on the waiting list and you take your turn." And I sort of liked that, you know, I hadn't thought about day school. So there they were. So that was, and then the, in order, quickly, Freddie McCall, and there's the McCall Award that goes to the mm-hmm. best teacher. Mm-hmm. Freddie McCall had graduated from here, an undergraduate where he played on the baseball team and had been in the band.
Right.
And so he went off to, I forget, Yale or Harvard Law School. And then when he finished, top of his class, he was offered a job here, teaching at the law school, or teaching classics in the classics department, or the assistant coach of the baseball team.
What a choice.
And he decided that he would come to the law school and be the assistant coach of the baseball team.
So at one point we had a law professor who was the assistant coach of the baseball team?
Yeah, Freddie McCall. And his interest was music. And he played the tambourine and the drums in the North Carolina Symphony, and all the time. And he ran he was in charge of the fundraisers for the North Carolina Symphony. And they'd always have the kickoff party for the big donors at his house, which is right across the street. And his wife, Mrs. McCall, was in charge of music education in the school system here. And she wrote some songbooks with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. She was very cosmopolitan, and Freddie had played with in college days and after in the summers on ocean liners, go back and forth. And he played with Skinny Innes or something, some bands that later became fairly big time. And he was a tap dancer, so at the parties he would always do a little tap dance with the
Now, was he about the same age as
he was there? He came here in 1922 or 3, and he taught real property. And he was on the Law Revision Commission, and they revised, when I came, he was revising the probate code, and then he revised the property code. And so these guys kept their hand in a lot of things. And then Herb Baer, with whom I stayed, taught admiralty and conflicts of law, and I have his book on admiralty up there, which he was writing at the time. And he had had a trial attorney in northern New Jersey around Newark, and he'd had a heart attack. And the doctor told him he could never go into a courtroom again. So he went to Cornell Law School and got an advanced degree for a year. And then he wrote to all Southern law schools saying, it's a Southern climb. I can't have winters and I can't climb stairs. So you have to have an elevator or else it all has to be one level. So he went to Wake Forest. Wake Forest offered him a job. And then in World War II, the Duke and Wake Forest and Carolina had one law school. They all merged and had it here, and he was the dean of that since he had the heart condition and couldn't do anything, and then he stayed on. So he did not come here in 1920, but he was of the same age, a little bit, just 5 years younger than the others. And his interest was the library, and he was the chairman of the fundraising group, Friends of the Library, and he wrote his book. And he liked to do electrical repair work. But he had his heart. Albert Coates was here. And Albert came here in 1923 or something. And his story is that he taught criminal law. And he'd come right from law school. And he hadn't had any practice, and he regretted it. So he had a distant cousin who was a highway patrolman in this area. So he decided to ride with his cousin, find out what really goes on. And he did, and then his cousin said, we know what we're doing, but we don't know if we're doing it right. Can't you give us some lectures? So he started to give lectures to the highway troop, and that was the origin of the Institute of Government. And that was his life. And he started it in the late 1920s with a highway patrol. Where the police academy. He started the police academy, and then it grew into all the other things. His first associate was Henry Brandis. He hired Henry Brandis to be the first staffer at the Institute of Government. Later they had Terry Sanford and God knows who else. So Albert kept the institute going, and when I came here, the institute, the building, had just been completed.
The one that they're in right now?
Yeah. And so we had a, when I came here, I had a 2 hours with every faculty member. And Albert took me to see the building. And then we went to his house to meet his wife and have some port or a sherry or something. And the right-hand door of his car would not open. So I had to get in the driver's seat door and go in the back and then climb around under the front seat. He said, "That damn door, I'll have to get it fixed someday." I told my wife. And he was oblivious of that sort of thing. He had his eye on big things. So that was Albert. So we've done...
Is that Henry Brandeis?
Henry Brandeis was the dean when I came here. And he came here to... He graduated from here, no, from undergraduate, and then went to Columbia Law School and worked for a big New York law firm and did tax work. And then Albert Coates hired him to come back to be in charge of teaching tax-related mm-hmm. people how to be better tax things. And then he also had a job at the State Internal Revenue Service, the Bureau of whatever, being a reviewer or mm-hmm. the brains mm-hmm. think tank. And then he was hired here in 1937 or thereabouts. And he was the first one hired since Dalzell came here in the late 1920s. Mm-hmm. And then nobody else was hired except Bill Aycock and then me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came here, I stayed at Henry Brandeis took me out for dinner, and he was then the head of the World Federalists, which is what its name implies, that one world.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone with, when Frank Graham had been at the UN, he had been sent to Indonesia, which had just won its independence from Holland. And was trying to, and there were a lot of tribal disputes and so on, and there were disputes with Holland still.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Graham went there to mediate the dispute between Indonesia and Holland, and he asked Henry to go with him as his assistant. So Henry went there, and that hadn't been too much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was the executive director of the World Federalists,
mm-hmm.
which almost stopped him from being the dean, because some trustees didn't like a World Federalist being the dean, but he survived it and was the dean. And when I came, he was about to run for the school board, and I asked him, "That's pretty low, I thought, you know, to run for the local school board." And he said, "Well, they were going to start integrating the schools here, and he wanted to make sure it was done the way it was supposed to be done." So that was very, very nice. John Dalzell, whom I mentioned, came here in the very late 20s from Minnesota. And he too was a one-worlder. And when he died, he left his property, his house here, to the Union Now with Great Britain, which had been very active in the 30s. And his interest was international law and the United Nations. And he was in charge of the debate
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And he also taught at NC Central. And the story there is that there is a Supreme Court decision around 1938 which said that up to that time, when blacks had applied in the southern states for colleges, or graduate schools, the state had paid their tuition to go to the Big Ten. And then the Supreme Court said, "No, you can't do that anymore." And it was a graduate school. If you have a graduate school, you can't send the blacks out of state. You have to let them in. Or you can start their own graduate school. Whereupon North Carolina decided to start a law school for blacks. So they wouldn't come to this one. And they put it at NC Central in Durham. And Van Hecke was their first dean. They asked him to do it. And the first faculty was our people and Duke people.
So you would work part-time at Central?
Yeah. And whatever you taught here, you'd teach over there. But they only had five or six of them. And it had been a couple of years before they hired a black to teach there. But John Dalzell had been an original teacher there, and he wanted to teach there. And he kept up his courses there and his courses here. And it was his motion that we didn't have any black faculty, and nobody did. And he made the motion that we bring the black faculty from NC Central to come over here and teach. So and he was not a firebrand at all. But that was John Dalzell. His interests were international law. And
did the school do it?
We offered. We offered a job to their dean, who was a great fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And this must have been in the very late 50s. And he accepted. And he was going to come over and start in the summer school, mm-hmm. when it would be easy. And he had a house there, and there were no problems. But he told us that he'd gone to see his doctor. His blood pressure had gone up. And his doctor told him he'd better not take the risk. The thought of integrating the university. And he was a man in his 50s, who mature and looked like Paul Robeson. Very nice guy, but it was just too much for him, which is amazing to think that. And then there is, I think there might have been one other who was Frank Hanf, H-A-N-F-T. And he'd come from Minnesota as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, he got out of Harvard graduate school. He'd been at University of Minnesota undergraduate in law school and had worked in the attorney general's office, mm-hmm. or something. And then had gone to the Harvard graduate school to get his advanced law degree. And he told me when he got out in 1927 that North Carolina paid more than any other law school. And he'd never been south, so he came to look at it, and came when the rosebuds were budding, and came here and stayed. And then he brought his friend John Dalzell a year or two later. And Frank Hanf was very active in the Methodist Church, and he wrote a couple of books on A Lawyer's Brief for Christianity or that sort. And he had a very large men's Bible school. And right after the war, he had 50 of the law students went every Sunday to his Sunday school class, mm-hmm. at the Methodist Church, including Bill Aycock and Dick Phillips and all of them. And then there was when Bill Aycock was made the chancellor, which would have been 1957, his rival was Frank Hanf. Those were the two final contestants. And it chose Bill Aycock. But, so Frank was, he taught the commercial law courses, and his concerns were more, and he'd been a colonel in the Army Reserve, in the Army, and he was interested in the plight of the veteran, and so on. So that's the faculty I joined, 10 of them, all of them in their 60s, except for Henry Brandis. All of them been here. The day they used to have the freshmen, and they'd have an orientation program of 3 days, which ended up with a dinner. And then we always had the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court would say something. And then Henry Brandis would introduce the faculty. And when I was there, my first night, so to speak, he said that collectively, there's 32 years average experience.
Yeah.
So that was everybody came, they enjoyed it, they found a niche, mm-hmm. and they stayed.
Huh. So you were in your mid-30s when you...
I was in my mid-30s, yeah.
How did it feel to be younger than the rest of the staff?
Well, I felt rather odd. I was the kid on the block. I was the young man, and the students couldn't empathize real well with all the people in their 60 who were very polite and gentlemanly and very knowledgeable. You couldn't question them about something. Couldn't ask Freddie McCall that he's wrong on the rule of Dumper's case or something. So it was, but we came here, and Susie was born that August. We came in September, and she was born in August.
So this is your third child?
Third child, and all the time that I was refusing to sign the loyalty oath and was looking for jobs, my wife was pregnant. Mm-hmm. So we were thinking the other day, it was sort of a brave thing to do, but it didn't occur to me at the time it was anything mm-hmm. other than what any ordinary human being would do. Mm-hmm. But,
so what was the reaction of the faculty here about?
Well, then I had to go see, there's one other, Breckenridge, and he'd come here, and his son had been a CO in World War II. So everyone in Wadgett refused to sign the oath, mm-hmm. and we had these philosophical discussions, and hadn't been quite as friendly at Pennsylvania. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm sort of a kook, you know. And then we had to go see Bill Aycock, who was the chancellor, just starting. No, he wasn't a chancellor yet. House was still the chancellor. We had to go see House. And House said, well, we have some forms which require you to disclaim. Says, but they're administrative forms. We made it up to head them off. And so I think what I'll do is you don't have to sign, and I'll make believe we don't have any more. So that took care of that problem. And then they wanted to let Bill Aycock know about it, too. So Bill Aycock said, oh, you know, if we're out of forms, we're out of forms. So that ended the loyalty oath here at UNC.
And, so that was the last?
Yeah.
I never used them.
Yeah.
They lost the forms.
They lost the forms. They never got new ones. And Chancellor House then retired. And he told me later that he signed my appointment and retired. And I never knew exactly what he meant by that. That was the last official act he did. And Bill Aycock took over. And I took over Bill Aycock's courses.
So what were you teaching when you started here?
Negotiable instruments.
Once again.
Once again. And sales, maybe, I forget. Oh, we had a course in legal method for all first year students.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like the research and writing course that we have now?
That sort of thing. More in depth, but we had a case book and mm-hmm. so on. So I taught that, and then shortly thereafter, Dick Phillips joined the faculty to visit, and he and I taught the legal method course. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came here and what I met. And I came here, we came in the springtime, and it was just beautiful. And then we came down in the summer. All this time I'd gone to Washington every summer and worked mm-hmm. for Joe Rao. Mm-hmm. And we came down from Washington, and we found an delightful little house on Rogerson Drive with all sorts of flowers. And so we thought that this would be an ideal place to stay until the kids were ready for the first grade. And it was 34 years ago. So we really didn't. I had no expectation of staying more than a couple of years.
In Chapel Hill.
Yeah. And then what happened was, we can talk about the next go-round, but I got involved in social problems, and mm-hmm. this seemed to be the cutting-edge place where the problems were the tough, but also I was protected.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a safe haven here,
mm-hmm.
and I could sally out and do justice and then run back. So it was hands-on type of problems. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you want to stop now?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.